patreon.com/thewalkoffpodcast. $4 a month gets you in there.
Baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's the walk-off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard podcast for the casual fan.
And another one. My goodness.
It is a Monday morning mailbag on a Tuesday afternoon kind of day. Hello and welcome to the walk-off, everybody. I'm Scott Belford, joined as always by Adam Mack. This is what we're doing. We combed through all of the interaction from the last week, and we are now going to answer your questions and shine a light on your comments. We do really appreciate all of you who have reached out or have left a comment. You can, of course, always do so on Twitter at Walk Off Podcast, on Instagram, The Walk Off Podcast. You can shoot us a message for a link to our Discord. We happily send those out. It's a happening place to be when it comes to Blue Jays talk and baseball talk in general. And then, of course, Patreon, a tip of the hat to you. You always get priority when it comes to your comments and questions, so we will get to as many of those as possible. Just a heads up, this is going to be a little bit shorter of a mailbag because we literally sit down and chat with Rob Friedman, pitching ninja, in 1 hour. So we need to make sure to be properly prepared for that. That, by the way, is going to be released tomorrow morning. The pitching ninja joining us here on the walk-off. So set your calendars, get ready for that. It's going to be a good one. All right, my friend, let's get this going.
Okay. First of all, a lot of comments about me being a bozo, which, you know, I always welcome and love. This time in regards to the fact that I don't know what science is, after my frustrated rant yesterday about advanced metrics and people citing them as gospel. So I just need to get a few points of clarification across here right off the bat. First of all, loads of comments, appreciate the comments, but basically all of them boil down to this. Gathering data and analyzing the info is literally the definition of science. And while I appreciate that, that is not the point that I was attempting to get at. It was not a tangent I had prepared to go on leading into yesterday's episode. I was riffing as I do. But I do want to clarify, I still stand by my stance. It's funny when people focus on the wrong part of your argument and then extrapolate that. It's, you know, straw man fallacies, or I don't know. I'm going to riff again, and now I'm going to get torn apart in the comments again. And I'm already frustrated with myself. Point is, I don't have a problem with advanced metrics and whatever.
No, that I think never your point.
I think that there are, I mean, yes, is batting average an outdated statistical measurement? Sure. Like, I can agree that there are better ways to score performance of a player. I just think that a lot of times we point to numbers like a guy's UZR and we go, there you go, he's definitively a better defender than the next guy because his UZR is higher. And it's just like not the case that it's... It's frustrating. Anyways, I could write a whole article, except I don't know good English. So that article would not go well. Please save
me. I do think it's important to state there's a gray area in every aspect of life. And to just take anything as black and white, yes or no, there's only one way to do anything, is going to get you into trouble and is only short-sighted in the long run. It's why baseball has developed so many stats and so many analytics, is because to boil it down to one little aspect is only going to leave you without all of the information on the other end of things. And I think your point was, when it comes to these, analytics, it's that to take them as gospel and to take them as black and white and to take it as this is going to be without argument the way to go by it is silly. And this is why front offices don't do it. And that was your point. Your point was that the front office has more information than any of us fans, as dialed in to fan graph as you can possibly be. There's still information that we just don't know. Maybe I was misinterpreting your point, but that's how I took it.
That's just it, is that these complicated algorithms and calculations are all well and good, and they're sure interesting, but I do feel like there is like a...
And they hold value.
They do. They do, sure. But they, everything is like not as black and white as a lot of the public seems to feel like they are. And that's where it gets like into the realm of pseudoscience for me, is that people take something that is like an incomplete picture and present it as, well, here's the thing. And it's like, that's still not quite right. And that is like the definition of pseudoscience, is claiming that a...
Like every fan has their favorite stat that they hold more weight with, right? You know, like, you're not a war guy, but there are literally fans who feel that wins above replacement is the most important stat. There are fans that feel that OPS plus is the most important stat. There are fans that feel that weighted runs created is the best way to judge a player. And this is what baseball fans have been trying to do for forever, which is boil things down to one number, one stat. This is what analytics have tried to do, right? And it's just impossible to do.
And like, I'm on the FanGraphs definition of UZR right now, ultimate zone rating, right? And like, they take in a park factor, right? For fielding balls in Houston is different than fielding the same type of hit in Seattle, right? And every ballpark is different based on a number of factors, different zones in each factor, right? Like left field in Fenway has a different ballpark factor than right field in Fenway. And for obvious reasons, when it comes to dimensions and wall height, and I get that. But to just assign a factor value of, well, this left field is a 0.86 is just, it's arbitrary numbers. And that's where I get into the, like, this is hokey. This is not,
it's not
real. Like, to say that
science.
So, and it's, that's all I'm saying.
Amazing that they've gotten it as close to a perfect science as they have, honestly.
Sure. It is, again, very impressive with how far they've come, and it is very useful information. But to pretend that this is the be all end all is just ludicrous to me.
The one thing you brought up yesterday that really stood out to me when you were giving examples of factors that may not be introduced into these equations, right? Take the Rogers Center. So how are they using the number on that to factor into anything that they're using stadiums as a number, right? Because basically Rogers Center is two stadiums in one. The ball flies differently when that roof is open or when it's closed. And is that taken into account? Like, I don't know, maybe it is, but
so it is, according to FanGraphs, and again, I could waste 45 minutes doing a whole thing on this. That would be super
boring. Because analytics are cool. Like, I do love...
They are cool. They're very interesting. Yeah. But, like, the park factor, quote-unquote, is only adjusted as major revisions happen to the field. So, like, if, like, when Toronto put a new outfield wall dimension...
They
park factor gets updated. I get that. That's cool. If they put in a new AstroTurf or some sort of a new type of grass or whatever, the numbers get adjusted. But also, like, to look at Seattle and go, well, it has a park factor of 1.0 because of this and because it's ultimately like a cooler climate than Houston. Like, I get that, like, balls travel differently in a cooler climate than a warm climate. But if that's just we're taking it on the 162, or I guess the 81 game average in Seattle, and not accounting for the fact that, like, Seattle can still have days in the 40s. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe it's generally cooler, but are we gonna, if we're not taking it on a day by day basis, let's just take it all out altogether. Like, let's not pretend that climate is a factor if we're not I don't know. That's where it gets frustrating for me, Scott.
I do wish to clear up here that, by the way, everybody, we are not arguing that analytics are shit. That is not that is not the argument at all. They are the most important thing in all of baseball. And I think our offices show that.
We have come a long way in analytics. I just don't like hearing from people that we have come to the end. We have not.
Yes.
There is so much more data that needs to be whatever. It doesn't even need to be. But just like, don't pretend that this is the conclusive. This is
the
it.
Nerds aren't
figured
done.
It out. No,
the guys in khakis aren't done. They are going to find more and more factors that are going to change those numbers, and they're going to include those into their analytics and into their equations. And there's going to be a new number in the next 5 years that is going to be more accurate than right now. It's just the way it works, and it has in the history of the sport.
So Scott Carter on YouTube had said, I feel there's a difference between, I feel here is a difference between the teams and fans is not the information available. It is the available, this English is as bad as mine. Okay. Basically what Scott's getting at here is it's not about a difference in they have better data than the public consumer does. It is just that they have, they are better to properly use the data.
Right.
And sure, like that,
as they
may or may not be the case. But of course, they have better data and better people analyzing the data. Of course. Okay. It goes on to say you can use stats to make the average person believe anything. It's a lot harder to fool a well-trained statistician. I mean, I don't know if I even necessarily believe that. I do think that like they are making better. Whatever, but look, I was reminded of this. I think it's a Mark Twain quote, but it's like, it's easier to fool people than to convince them that they've been fooled. You ever heard this before?
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I feel like on all of these advanced metrics and analytics is like, there is a real excitement and enthusiasm behind it. So a lot of people get caught up in that. And then once they get attached to UZR or DRS or XERA or whatever, they get so excited that they've found the new shiny toy. And I don't know if it's a like, I'm smarter than you mentality, but they don't want to then acknowledge that the thing that they found isn't complete.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So anyways, just a lot of snobby people.
It's getting
and I
there.
Love it.
That's the thing, right? It's like the gray area talk again. It's like, yeah, unfortunately, we just live in a world where there is no one way to do anything. And that is constantly proved as time goes on.
Yeah, I don't know. If Bobichette's hitting 375 with six home runs and like 11 RBIs through the first 3 weeks of the season, he's having a pretty good season. I don't need advanced analytics to tell me otherwise.
But, yeah.
We've spent enough time on this.
Okay.
Anyways, Bobichette Cards DM'd us on Twitter.
Yes. Said,
this kind of ties in here. What if I told you that Bobichette has been better than Matt Chapman this season defensively, according to outs above average and defensive runs saved that everybody loves using? As of right now, Matt Chapman has a -1 defensive run saved and Bo has a 0. And Chapman has a -3 outs above average and Bo has only a -2. So,
friend of the show, Blake Murphy, who is far more intelligent when it comes to breaking down analytics than Adam and I could ever hope to be. But he brought something up a couple days ago about the defensive metrics. Outs above average and defensive runs saved. Both of these tend to be far more accurate over a long period of time. So unlike batting average, which is cumulative and also, mind you, is going to show a much more accurate representation of what a hitter is in the long term, right? It's why we always talk sample size. But defensive metrics, more than any other metric, are very inaccurate when it comes to small sample sizes because one little mishap really affects you in that short period of time. So for the fans out there that are reading into outs above average and defensive runs saved, using those metrics in the first 10 to 20 games of the season really isn't going to paint the picture that we're going to see at the end of the season. However, Bo Bichette cards, I think it is correct. Right now, the numbers show that Matt Chapman is having a tougher time defensively than Bo Bichette. Now, this is why the eye test still exists. This is why there are still the old school managers out there, the old heads, if you will. They still have value in this game for exactly that reason.
Yep.
But I appreciate you reaching out, and that's an interesting stat to bring up.
When you talk about these defensive metrics being more useful in the long term, UZR is the same way. I was reading an interesting article this morning as I was prepping for the show, and Michael Lichtman is the mathematician. I don't know if that's what he is. The smart guy that came up with UZR, even like himself says, look, it is best used as a measurement looking backwards over the past three seasons. Right. And then he says, even the problem with that is that if you're evaluating how good is a defender and you're looking at their past three seasons, people regress. Like as people age, they get worse. So this year, if we're measuring Matt Chapman based on the last 3 years of his UZR, his UZR score does not represent the player he actually is today. So it's all fun, but yeah.
All of this math is really meant to just try and predict where you're going to get success out of a guy in the future. But without a crystal ball and being able to tell the future, it really is impossible to get it right. You're just hoping to guess the most accurate, you know, you're hoping to take the information you have and make the most accurate guess you can.
It just, I guess maybe why I don't like it is it feels like someone that's trying to say, look, I know Matt Chapman looks like a good defender, but here's the data that says he's not, or that this guy's technically better. Like the quote unquote eyeball test is like not an acceptable measurement.
No, it's not an acceptable argument. Absolutely.
But I feel like then people find these like complicated algorithms and they go, well, this is more complicated than the eyeball test, so it must be true. And it's like, well, it's truer maybe, but it doesn't, I don't know. Anyways, we're going down a whole rabbit hole again.
Yeah, we'll end on this with the stats stuff. But I will say I use stats all the time to argue my points in baseball. Yeah. I am not poo-pooing analytics by any means, and neither is Adam. So let's end it there. We are not against analytics. I love analytics. I love stats. I love what they provide. They are not perfect. Sorry.
Thank you. Okay, next one.
We are going to get shit on so bad for this.
Yeah, we're going to, I know.
Just it's, like, I don't even want to check the comments on this.
I don't either. It'll be great. It'll be great. Anyways. Okay, next one comes in from James Brooks, tweeted at us and said, I wonder if the pitch clock has affected Manoa more than we thought. What do you guys think? Alek Manoa, pitch clock, is that why he's struggling? What do the analytics say, Scott?
So I spent almost 40 minutes, and I mean this. I truly mean this. I spent 40 minutes Googling and trying to find the average time between pitches for Alek Manoa in 2022. And I'm sure the stat is out there, and if there is some sort of magician,
grounds crew, get on that.
Grounds crew, get on that. I would love that data, because that truly will point to how much that 15 seconds between the pitch clock right now is affecting him. Right? If we look at it, and Alek Manoa's difference between pitches was like 15 seconds last year, then that's not the answer. And I think when you look at Alek Manoa and you listen to some of these. Much smarter baseball analyst than Adam and I, you know, a lot of it has to do where he's landing with his front foot and following through in his delivery. This seems to be the general consensus when you're talking to guys like Joe Siddle, right? Friend of the show, Jamie Campbell, brought it up. However, it does make sense that this is something that has changed from last year. And Adam and I have talked about this since the opening day of the season. Alek Manoa has not looked comfortable on the mound. whether it's a confidence thing, whether this is his first bump in the road in his career, or whether it truly is that he's feeling rushed and maybe he's a little out of breath more than he's used to. He doesn't have the option of, you know, after a couple pitches wandering around the mound, or, you know, Kirky taking his sweet time getting the ball out of his glove to throw it back. So yeah, maybe he is rushed, and maybe that is contributing to him not following through with his delivery, which would make sense, right? You're rushing, your delivery's off. Maybe it's all one thing together.
I would go so far as to say, unless his average time between pitches is well under 15, that it would be a factor. Again, I don't know how much of a factor. Let's just assign a factor of 0.86 because analytics, why not?
Not how it works, but I love this. Yes.
Oh my God. No, but I'm just saying, for especially maybe, again, I don't know if a young pitcher would be more affected or a veteran who's set in his ways like Max Scherzer. Max Scherzer's mm-hmm. come out and said he's been more affected by the pitch clock than he anticipated. But I mean, if Alek Manoah's time between pitches last year is 19 seconds, then obviously he's having to pick up the pace, right? That's going to have
substantially.
Sure. But even if his time between pitches is like 13 or 14 on average, that means that sometimes it's 11, sometimes it's 19, right? So there are going to be for sure instances in which he would have had more time and he now is rushed. Also, how much does that just affect the mentality of, like, just in the back of your mind, like, I got to keep up the pace here? It's just one more thing to consider, and that might just be enough. So I don't think necessarily seeing like, oh, his average time between pitches was only 11 seconds last year, so that's not it. And I don't remember Alek Manoah feeling like a particularly quick pitcher.
Slow pitcher. I mean, he didn't.
He's not Rafael Dolis out there, but also he's not chop, chop, let's get at it, pitter patter. Like, come on.
No, for sure.
So, yeah, I mean, that's probably a factor. I don't know if it's any more of an impact on his pitching other than it is just like you add one more thing to consider to anybody, no matter what that thing is, it's going to impact performance, right? We speculated about guys going through a divorce. That's just something. That's one more thing on the back of their brain that they're considering all day long.
And so, there is a psychology to a clock ticking down too, that is interesting, right? Because it does make you feel more rushed. Whether the truth is even if Alek Manoah wasn't, his average time between pitches wasn't over that 15 seconds, it just being in his head and watching that second tick down to zero, it absolutely is going to make you feel rushed.
Yeah. I mean, we've all sat through exams in high school or university or grade school where it's like, hey, you have 60 minutes for this physics test. And you're like, oh my God. Yeah. So you're like, okay, I don't want to run out before I get all these questions done. And then you get every question done and you have like 17 minutes left. And then you're
exactly.
Like, oh, now I got to go back and double check everything because I rushed.
It's almost like had they told you on average, it takes you 45 minutes to do a test. You have 60 minutes, but it's just that having that time limit, man, it's just like, it gets in your head. You're like, ah.
Here's a funny behind the scenes. I mean, everybody who follows us on Patreon is well aware of this, but if Scott and I set a time for like 9 o'clock in the morning, we're going to do an interview or we're going to do whatever. We're going to do a podcast at 9 a.m. And then Scott will text me at like 7:30 and he'll be like, hey, I'm up and I'm awake. And if you're ready to go, we can start early if you want. And then all of a sudden, now there's like, I feel a pressure, a responsibility to you, Scott, where I'm like, oh, Scott's ready. I better get going. So I'm like rushing through making my coffee. And all of a sudden, I'm not only not getting ready in time for the 9 o'clock that we had initially set, I'm actually like 20 minutes behind somehow.
And vice versa. This has happened to both of us numerous times. One of us reaches out, we're like, we could go early. And the other one's like, oh no.
So there you go. I mean, the psychology of the clock is a real thing. I'm sure anybody watching this can relate to anecdotes like that in their real life where they're like, oh yeah, whenever my wife says, hey, make sure you get that yard cleaned up by 4 o'clock
before I get home,
gives me a little bit of anxiety or whatever, right?
Yeah,
whatever. Anyways, Alek Manoah, I don't know what's going on there, but it's
Pitch something clock is something that could be contributing, though. Absolutely.
Okay. Next one comes in from Malid. Says, I don't think there's a shortstop in the game right now that doesn't have a flaw. Whether it's Correa, Lindor, or anyone else, they all have areas they're not great at. If Bo's arm is his biggest issue, then I'm okay with him making five more errors than the pack over 162 if he can lead the league in hits. Thoughts?
I feel the same way. I think that's a pretty good take on Bo Bichette and his defense, right? If he's going to be below average defensively, but way above average offensively, you got to take it. This is a dead horse that we have been beating to death, but yeah.
Yeah. I'll take 162 games out of Bo, regardless of his defense. Like,
yeah,
that's a flaw. I mean, if we're listing guys like Carlos Correa, I'll take 162 games of Bo Bichette over 100 games from Carlos Correa.
Even if Correa's defense is substantially better in that 100 games. Yeah. There's something to be said. There is a value that you can't put a number on to being able to pencil a guy into a position like shortstop without thinking twice about it. It's actually one of the big things that I think John Schneider has going for him in center field right now. It's like last year, it was a real question mark. Who is playing center today? Mm. And this year it's like, who cares? Whoever's there is going to be awesome. Right.
Yeah. On long toss on Sunday, I think it was Joel describe Bo's attitude of like just throwing the damn ball, even if he like doesn't have a play to be made. Just that, like, you know, sometimes he's gonna throw it in the dirt or it's whatever, and like the guy's safe anyways. But it's like there's no downside. There's downside the 20 times a year where he throws it into the stands and the guy gets the extra base, right? But if Bo's making a calculation that like, hey, 21 times I'm going to throw it and make the out, then that's the trade-off, yeah. I guess. Right. So yeah. I don't know. What's the UZR on that? But let's move on from there. Shall we? Anything else to add on Bo Bichette? He's pretty good at shortstop.
He's pretty good at shortstop, or at least at hitting. That was all from Twitter, by the way. Twitter is getting to the point where I'm getting half a dozen to a dozen DMs a day, which is awesome. So a big thank you to the grounds crew and all of you who just love talking baseball enough to reach out.
Leave Scott alone, he says. Quit messaging him so much. Every day he messages me and he goes, man, I'm getting overwhelmed with all these DMs on Twitter.
That's actually a really good impression.
Thanks.
I got the voice and everything.
Yeah. Where's my son? I dressed up as Scott Belford for Halloween last year, so I have the glasses too, but I can't seem to find them right now. Anyways, all right, let's move on from there then. Anything else to add? We're good. Bo Bichette, really good.
Really good.
Okay, next one from Discord. Oh, this is a clarification from...
Oh, yeah, nice.
...yesterday on Gabriel Moreno. So Gabriel Moreno... fun little quirky anomaly in his stats this year, has a lower on base percentage than batting average. 99% of the time it's the other way around, right? Because the way it's
99.9% of the time.
So batting average is what, hits divided by at bats. Yes. Whereas on base percentage is like hits plus walks divided by plate appearances.
Yes.
So difference being, if you have a sac fly or hit by pitch, those are not at bats. Those are plate. Mm-hmm. Those are plate appearances, but not at bats.
So if you hit a sacrifice fly, it does not count against your batting average. However, it does count against your on base percentage.
You might have that backwards. Okay, let's just read what Ian said, shall we?
Sure.
a note on how on-base percentage can be lower than average early in season. I only know this because I asked a couple years ago. You can see this in small sample size from a player that doesn't walk much but has hit a few sacrifice flies or bunts, as those don't count in batting average but do for on-base percentage. So there you go, Scott.
Yeah. So perfect. Thank you, Ian.
There you go. Thank you, Ian. All right, a couple more to get to here. Again, shorter mailbag than usual, but with the pitching ninja.
It's all worth it for pitching ninja coming up here, yes.
You got to get to that, and we got a lot of fan questions to make sure to get to for him as well. So, okay, next one is Donnie D says, if you believe the Jays should or can go 1-5 in the next six games, then why even consider them a playoff team? If they can't go 500 against playoff teams, then are they really contenders? So thank you, Donnie, for the comment. This obviously comes on the back of past Friday's week three preview, when we looked at the upcoming schedule against the Rays and the Astros, the pitching matchups that we had. And I had said, yeah, Jays could go 0-6 or 1-5. So a couple points I want to make here. I wasn't saying that I thought the Jays would go 0-6. Maybe I said that again, because I'm a bozo. What I meant to say, or what I believe I said, was that, look, this is a possibility. Buckle up.
These are tough teams. They're good teams. Yeah.
I think I started the episode with like verbally saying, as a reminder to myself, the Jays could go 1-5 or 0-6 this week. Don't panic.
Yeah. Listen, to answer the question, in my opinion, 162 games, all sorts of things happen. The Jays are probably going to go 1-5 against bad teams at some point this year, and that does not mean that they're not a playoff team. There's ebbs and flows to a season in baseball. So why would we consider them a playoff team and then also think it's possible for them to go 1-5 against two of the best teams in baseball? Because that's the way it works.
Astros are the defending champs. Rays were one of the hottest teams in baseball. That's enough of a reason, right? Like,
yeah.
You can even saying,
take,
I thought
you can
we
even
were going to have
one
a,
of the hottest teams out of that sentence.
There you go. The hottest team in baseball. As far as the thought about, like, if the Jays can't beat good teams, then are we even a contender? I'm just going to point to last year's season end standings. So October 5th, 162 games for every team. But you can look back in previous years and it all shapes out kind of the same way. 12 playoff teams last year, only six had a winning record against teams over 500. Blue Jays included had a 45-49 record against teams over 500.
What was Philadelphia's record? Do you have that?
Ooh, it's gross. Philadelphia was 34-47. There were 13 games under against teams over 500.
All the way to the World Series, and they were 12 games under 500 against teams above 500. That is why I think the Blue Jays are still a playoff team, even if they do lose to good teams here and there.
The Rays also last year, 41-48 against teams over 500.
It's about getting hot at the right time, and anything can happen in a seven-game series. It's giving yourself the chance to win. If you can come out of that wild card game, really anything can happen. Pitchers get hot, hitters get hot, pitchers get cold. You never know what's going to happen. And I mean, the 88-win World Series champion Braves from 2021 proved that. The 87-win Philadelphia Phillies that were one win away from going to Game 7 of the World Series proved that.
By the way, Atlanta Braves, the year they won the World Series, were 31-37 against teams over 500.
Six games under 500.
Games under. So, yeah, that's why.
Thank you for the question, though.
There you go. Thank you for the question. Valid.
If we seemed sassy there at all, that wasn't exactly how we were trying to come off. More just
I'm still just worked up about my analytics rant from earlier. So all right. Last one to end on, then we'll get out of here, is Ricky Tiedemann. This comes in from Royal T. Says Ricky Tiedemann is pretty dang good right now. Does he really need a lower walk rate? So that's, I mean, we talked about this. I think, I don't know if it was before his debut in AA or just after. But the question was, what does he need to do to demand a spot on this team, right? How does he force the Blue Jays' hand into saying, you know what? He's too good in the minor leagues. We can't ignore this, and he needs to be on the major league team. That was the question, right? So Ricky Tiedemann, career walk rate in the minor leagues is 3.2 walks per nine. Let me pull
Which
up
isn't Alec. Terrible.
It's not terrible, but again, it's not like, it doesn't show to me that he has like outgrown the minor leagues yet, whether it's control issue or whatever the case may be. If we look at Alek Manoah's stats, just because it's the obvious comparison to look at, right? These two.
Sure, the last big young stud pitcher we had come up through the minors, for sure.
So Alek Manoah, minor league stats, had a career walk rate in the minors of 2.1.
Okay, so that, a full walk less per nine.
That walk rate in AAA that season, because we all remember he had a great spring training in 2021. We were wondering, is he going to make the team potentially, right? He ended up not, went to AAA, pitched three starts down there, had a walk rate of 1.5.
Yeah.
And a K rate of 13.5. That was the kind of numbers where you go, all right, well, he is just outgrown minor league baseball at that point. And that was at AAA. Mm-hmm. So
now that said, Ricky Tiedemann, of course, made his minor league debut for 2023 just a few days ago. And in that start, he went three innings. He walked one and he struck out nine. So
every out he got was a strikeout.
That's
really good. But I'm just, again, we're picking warts off of a really shiny new toy here. Like, this is, we're nitpicking, right? But
yeah,
it is also like, you know, we're talking about, what does he have to do to force the Blue Jays' hand? Like, how does he be so good they can't ignore him? That's just one area that he can improve.
Yeah.
So
I the Blue Jays are by no means in a rush for Ricky Tiedemann. I do think we are going to see him in 2023 at some point, but I do think that they are going to let him develop, continue to develop in double A until he is so much better that they need to move him to triple A. The hope is that they're moving him to triple A in May. And that by July, we're all like, my God, how do we keep Ricky Tiedemann in triple A any longer?
Well,
but they're going to make him, they're going to make him push his way on.
If he has two more starts in double A where he's going,
he's just striking out every single guy.
Nine strikeouts over three innings or eight. Yeah. Strikeouts over three, and he does that two or three more times. Like, of course, off to AAA immediately.
Forget about the walk rate. He can
forget about the walk
there.
Rate. He can sort that out in Buffalo. But and then once you get to Buffalo, then you go, okay, he's continuing to show that kind of dominance. Then you go, all right, well, let's now. Now there is the question, but yeah, I mean, really nitpicking here to say, what can Ricky Tiedemann do to be better, other than prove it at the major league level? But that's out of his hands. So what is in his hands? Lower the walk rate. That's the only thing I have. All right. That's it for mailbag. We got Pitching Ninja joining us in 23 minutes. If you're watching this mailbag on a Tuesday, that interview will be out tomorrow, Wednesday.
First thing, Rob Friedman, Pitching Ninja, pretty darn excited for this one. Thank you to everyone for all the interaction over the week. We truly do appreciate you, the grounds crew, the listeners. You can always reach out by DMing us on Instagram, the Walk Off Podcast, or on Twitter at Walk Off Podcast. Send us a message if you're into joining the Discord. We will send you a link to do that. And of course, the Patreon. We truly appreciate all of you who are spending that buck a week to get all those little extra features that are offered in Patreon. We do appreciate it. All the best, everybody. Rob Friedman, tomorrow morning. Cheers.
Bye, Dad. Okay. I forgot when it's not important, but the other comment I was getting on analytics was people saying that like spin rate and shit is like literally aerodynamics and that's literally a science. And like, I've never once ever complained about like spin rate as an analytic, like the Rapsodo machine and all that, and what they're able to like track on like pitch movement and stuff. Yeah, I've never once called that a pseudoscience. I love it. I'm a believer in like measuring pitches and spin
but
rate.
People it's are a, idiots. They hear what they want to hear, dude. Like literally, that's the biggest thing. If you were to go back and literally clip what you said, it's not even close to half the arguments they're fucking making, right?
Like, the thing is, like I complain about advanced analytics, and then again people just jump to like, well, here's one that's good and you're an idiot, and it's like, sure, there are some that are good. It's exhausting. Anyways, yeah. I gotta get ready for this interview, so I'm gonna rip through the comments.
Do your thing right. Are you just gonna leave this on, or do you want to just come back in 10 minutes?
Let's come back in 10 minutes because I got to stop this recording, and then okay, it's got to process for a few minutes, so
okay, let's do that.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack, with a new episode every Friday.
Oh! Osborne with a drive. Cheese and crackers. They chose to pitch to him. Wrong move.
Thanks for listening.